Hallo und herzlich willkommen im Etablissement, dem kleinen Theater-Podcast für die Dame, die erst vor kurzem ihre Disney Plus Subscription gekündigt hat, auch wenn sie deswegen im Moment die Lilith Fair-Dokumentation nicht schauen kann. Schade. Bevor es mit Episoden aus dem deutschsprachigen Raum weitergeht, wollte ich nochmal ein Resümee ziehen. Was waren so die prägenden Momente auf meiner Recherchereise durch Amerika? Der ganze Trip war ja nun sehr viel länger als 3 Monate. Also ich war 1 Monat in New York, dann bin ich über Chicago nach Kalifornien gereist und habe da 2 Monate verbracht, im Thomas-Mann-Haus gewohnt und hatte die Gelegenheit, so an die, ich würde mal sagen, 20 Interviews zu führen mit Leuten, die im unterhaltenden Theaterbereich unterwegs sind, um einfach auch mal so zu hören, wie sprechen die über ihre Arbeit, wie produzieren die, wo kommen die her, wie entsteht bei denen quasi so der Wunsch, danach Theater zu machen und was für eine Art von Kunst ergibt es auch. Natürlich auch in Anbetracht der Tatsache, dass das eine sehr kommerzielle Art des Theaters ist, die sie da machen, nochmal sehr viel anders als dieses subventionierte System, was wir hier haben, was natürlich auch seine Vor- und Nachteile hat. Dazu muss man sagen, dass ich in einer politisch sehr aufgeladenen Zeit da gelandet bin, also so mehr oder weniger kurz nach der Amtseinführung von Donald Trump, was die Theaterschaffenden, mit denen ich mich dort unterhalten habe, natürlich sehr beschäftigt hat. Also ich habe mich entschlossen, dieses Resümee eher intuitiv zu ziehen, mich rückblickend zu erinnern, was waren so entscheidende, interessante Momente in den Gesprächen, die mir hängen geblieben sind. Und wer weiß, vielleicht ergibt sich da im Zusammenklang ja eine Art von durchgehendem roten Faden oder so etwas wie eine Art Fazit oder vielleicht auch ein Fazit aus 15 verschiedenen Richtungen, das man da ziehen kann. Vielleicht kann man auch gar keins ziehen. Das wäre ja auch okay. Wahrscheinlich kann man keins ziehen. Kann man überhaupt jemals eins ziehen? Who knows? Deswegen fange ich gleich an mit der Begegnung mit James Nicola, der über 20 Jahre lang Leiter des New York Theater Workshops war, wo ja Stücke wie Rent, Slave Play, Hadestown ihren Anfang nahmen. Und Rent ist dann natürlich überhaupt so eine Legende und Jonathan Larson kam auf seinem Fahrrad vorbei und hat James Nicola auf einer Kassette ein Demoband vorbeigebracht mit den ersten Songs aus dem Stück. Und was aus Rent geworden ist, das wissen wir alle. James ist einfach eine Theaterlegende und hat viel Theater in Europa gesehen und viel Theater in Amerika gesehen. Also springen wir rein in unsere kleine Rückblicksrevue. Hier ist James Nicola.
I come from a very adolescent culture, 14-year-old, and it's very emotional and very unstructured and finding its way. And there's many wonderful things about that. But when you're in a place like over there, you see, oh, well, this is a mature, thoughtful, intentional, not, again, good things and bad things, but it's more chosen. Mm-hmm. Then this is sort of like throw it all up.
You think like America is this
yes.
adolescent?
Yes. Kind yes. of culture. Yes. Okay. Very much so.
Because it's so young.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And it was founded on such radical ideas that are still very much being tested and challenged and worked through, lived, as opposed to just conceptually.
Yeah.
In Germany, particularly, history is very present. Mm-hmm. In America, we don't even think about it. We don't even know that it exists. And I'm a person who is very much from childhood, from my first memories are, how did it get to be the way that it is? Like, why is that wall there? And that. So, and it has only grown with my life as it's unfolded. That certainly has carved out a place for me in this culture because I'm different than most in more ways than that. Mm-hmm. But to back to your conversation and what's going on, I think there's a foundational unconscious level in human beings in any community that's forged, be that a nation, a city, whatever. Mm-hmm. And there are things underneath the consciousness that are values and important ideas that play out and dominate behavior and choices made. And one has to be very rigorous with oneself about tracking where does that need to do that come from. And we don't think too much about that. However, what's beneath all of this for Americans, I believe, is the sort of religious Puritanism that founded this earliest part of European occupation in this part of the world, at least forged this country. Mm-hmm. The religious wackos that got kicked out of England because they were too nutty came here and started it all. And we have that within us. And the biggest thing that I contend with on that is that it shapes the mind to expect life as it unfolds to be good or evil. You're either with Jesus or you're with Satan. And if you're not with Jesus, you're with Satan.
That's it.
Yep.
Okay. But what kind of theater does this...
Well, it doesn't allow theater, first of all, for 200 of the 300 years that we've been existing, because that was not in church. It was satanic. So only to like mid-19th century, which was, you know, well into it, did we start to think about maybe we like being with Satan.
So and maybe, theater is Satan.
Yes. Unless you make money. Or gain fame, or both, even better. Then that's with Jesus.
Oh, that's interesting, because in Germany, I would have said, like, the money
yes.
definitely Satan's side.
Yes, yes. That's what that's what's so wonderful for me to go and be in a different place. That's more attuned to what I believe.
Yeah.
Well, or I try to escape that sort of binary, you yeah. know, because as much as it would be convenient for life to be that clear as it unfolds.
Yeah.
In my experience, never is, ever.
Yeah.
Once in a while.
Yeah.
It's always a question of finding a balance and finding the defining element of a life, as far as I've now understood at 74, is the integrity with which you form this compromise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That you know why you're doing it and you're comfortable with the complex things within that choice, but it's not this or it's not that. It's something forged that you'd create,
yeah.
one creates. But also, theater and art occupy a very different place in the German mind and soul and cultural identity, and that you come to sit in a theater seat to figure out what you think.
Yes.
And here, you go and sit in a theater seat to be distracted from Jesus.
To feel.
To feel. To love spectacle. To see, you know, in the 19th century, a woman lift her leg, her skirt, so you could see her ankle. This transgressive element was really powerful. It was maybe a place you were a little bit ashamed to go to. And you didn't want to necessarily be seen. Whereas I felt in Germany, we're here because we love being here. We're here to congregate. So it felt
we don't give you only the ankle.
Right.
We give you.
Yes. Yes.
We're exactly. completely naked.
Yes. And fine.
Yeah, yes.
Fine.
Yeah.
James Nicola sprach hier ja so ein bisschen von dieser pubertären Haltung des amerikanischen Theaters. Also so ungestüm auf Entertainment aus. Auch so ein bisschen diese transgressive Seite des amerikanischen Theaters, das sich so als Gegenbewegung zu diesem Puritanismus in Amerika entwickelt hat. Deswegen vielleicht auch immer so dieses leicht anzügliche Zwinkern im amerikanischen Theater, was auch eine sehr unterhaltsame Seite haben kann. Und diese junge Seite, da musste ich an mein Gespräch mit Emma und Bailey denken, die so Nachwuchs-Theatermacherinnen sind. Gerade in New York ihr neues Stück Two Sisters Find a Box of Lesbian Erotica in the Woods gezeigt haben. Sie sind Autorinnen, spielen in dem Stück aber selber auch mit und haben jetzt im Gegensatz zu James Nicola, der über 70 ist, diese Perspektive der ganz jungen Theatermacherinnen in Amerika. Und es waren wahnsinnig unterhaltsame Gesprächspartnerinnen, so total Podcast geübt oder auch verkaufsgeübt auf eine Art, aber wahnsinnig smart, wahnsinnig weit für ihr junges Alter. Ja, ich fand das ein beeindruckendes Gespräch mit den beiden und hier ist ein kleiner Ausschnitt.
Congratulations on the title, by the way, because it was really, because I saw it, I could buy the tickets at TodayTix.
Yeah.
I saw the tickets without reading the thing, I just booked the ticket.
Wow, that's amazing.
Because of the title.
We always say, if you are interested in the title, then you'll be interested in the play.
Yeah. Yes.
It almost needs no further description.
Yeah.
Part of that is because that description was, it was written as the log line of what we were going to write, and then at a certain point, Bailey was like, well, what if that was just the title of the play?
Yeah.
Because it says everything that we need to say.
Yeah.
And it's tricky and it is sexy and it opens it's itself
funny.
Up. It's funny.
Yes.
Which is important to both of us. We're really also both interested in humor.
Yeah.
And we're interested.
Not very German.
We have lots of questions for you about German theater clapping culture.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, we can.
Culture.
We can talk
about
it. It's a like a way of torture.
Yes.
Something.
Totally.
Yeah.
But also it's very funny.
Yeah.
Like they're sort of like torture.
We couldn't believe it. We're like, oh my God, it's another round.
It was amazing.
Maybe you could make a project.
Yeah.
It's only clap.
We've talked about it.
It's
very inspired.
Probably a good idea. So is there a message to this piece? Was there something you thought before? Like, oh, this is what we want to say with a piece. Or was
we
it just doing
really, I think as playwrights, very allergic to that.
Yeah.
We are really allergic to any kind of didactic messaging through theater. We both, I think, made this piece because we really believe that you can go to the theater and experience something that is strange and weird and particular and perhaps not completely linear and still have like a really intellectual and deep and moving experience.
Yeah.
I found very interesting that it has like those both sides, like being very, you could feel that it's coming from a very experimental kind of place. But it's also very accessible and humorful, which is also sometimes, I don't know how your experience in Berlin theater was, like, which is also not very Berlin.
I mean, I think we both like the combination of high art, low art. You know, one of our touch points, touchstones, whatever, for this was the reality show, Extreme Sisters. But also we went to a bunch of archives and did real research about this.
It goes lesbian pornography.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah. And the On Our Backs archive in Providence, Rhode Island. But I think it is part of our mutual mission that a play or a project can be very grounded, have deep intellectual grounding, but also be really delightful and fun. And in fact, should be.
And that actually is like, an opening to invite more people to think more deeply. And you don't have to if you don't want to, but if you're interested in it, the bedrock and dramaturgy of this piece is really, really tightly knit. Like we made sure to make the grounding of this and the research of this really coherent so that we knew that when we were being really silly, we were being silly clowns, plus we were doing something that we thought had some, you know, historical backing in like lesbian theater history or experimental theater history in New York City, or even sort of like contemporary theater making in this city, which is, you know, always like flowers growing through concrete cracks.
Yeah.
And I think there's like a lot of theater that I like that uses alienation as like a tactic, but that's definitely not one of our tactics. We're very much like, welcome. Like I stand at the door and say hi. You know, this should be a place where everyone feels comfortable and entertained.
But is this like accessibility and this like humor and this like embracing people also part of selling? We have to be friendly, we have to be funny, we have to be humorous or something to engage the audience to come back and buy another ticket. Maybe that's...
Yeah, in some ways, I guess it could be construed as that. But I also think, you know, we're in this for the long haul.
Yeah.
And I've been building my personal audience for many years. And I do believe it's sort of an act of trust to come see a show. And I think the reason why we've had such great audiences is not only because the title has a certain promise, but because there's a certain promise associated with coming to see a show by one of us.
As our individual playwright selves, or I think we're both known for like quite funny work. And so our audiences already have that understanding that they're walking into something that is going to have some kind of humor at the center of it, or sort of like comedy, treating comedy as like an important
feature
tool.
Of the...
Yeah.
Right, exactly. And I also think, you know, we said this, you know, time and time again to each other, but we think of theater as an act of hospitality and as an art of hospitality, so that the show doesn't just begin and end when the lights go up and down, that the moment that you enter the theater, the moment that you come into our world, it is where we've invited you over for a dinner party and we're going to do some really great stuff with these great lights and sound and set, but that it really is a sense of hospitality and a sense of wanting to have like real exchange with people. So that, you know, in, you know, however many years when we do another piece, we hope that the people that came to see this piece will come see the next piece, regardless of what the title is or what it's about, because they know what we're interested in serving, both inside of the show itself and in the experience.
So, das waren Emma Horwitz und Bailey Williams, die natürlich an einem Ende der New Yorker Theaterszene produzieren. Also das sind frei produzierte kleine Sachen, die off-off-Broadway laufen. Beiden spielten im Here Performing Arts Center. So eine ganz andere Seite des amerikanischen Theaters habe ich mit Julia Murney besprochen, die vor Jahren eine der am längsten spielenden Elphabas im Blockbuster-Musical Wicked war. Da spielt Geld natürlich eine ganz andere Rolle und ist auf eine ganz andere Art spürbar als in so kleinen Off-Off-Broadway-Produktionen, die frei produziert sind, die vielleicht auf kleinen öffentlichen Förderungen beruhen. Und mit ihr habe ich über diese Seite der amerikanischen Theaterproduktion gesprochen. Und zwar das Geld und wie sehr man das spürt, wenn man auf der Bühne steht als Performerin. Denn auch in Deutschland gibt es ja den Druck an Theatern, dass eine Produktion ein Erfolg werden muss. Es ist nur selten quasi ein finanzieller Druck. Also es wird nicht erwartet, dass noch wahnsinnig viel Geld damit gemacht wird. Das Problem ist hier vielleicht eher, dass die Budgets eng sind, dass dafür das Geld nicht reicht, hierfür das Geld nicht reicht, dafür nicht genug Leute angestellt werden und so weiter. Das hört man ja so aus dem Stadttheaterbereich häufig. Das Geld liegt da ja nun auch nicht mehr oder nicht auf der Straße. Aber es gibt keine Produzenten, die am Ende erwarten, dass die Produktion einen riesigen Gewinn abwirft. Und diese Erfahrung hat man natürlich, wenn man in so einer Show wie Wicked mitspielt und eine der Hauptrollen dort spielt, die auch stimmlich wahnsinnig anspruchsvoll ist. Das ist so ein bisschen wie jeden Abend Tristan und Isolde singen im Musical-Bereich, wenn man diese Songs jeden Abend raushauen muss. Genau, und das ist eben ein ganz spezieller Druck, den vielleicht auch das Geld macht. Und über diese Seite habe ich mit Julia Murney gesprochen, also hier ein Ausschnitt.
Broadway is commercial theater.
Yeah.
Broadway is capitalism with jazz hands. But it's still capitalism. The bottom line is they are trying to make money. People are putting money in to try to make money back in the most simplistic of forms. If the definition of entertainment is like light and frothy and makes you laugh, that's not every show on Broadway. But there's some sort of heightened emotion that I think audiences look for specifically in a Broadway show, whether that emotion is laughter, tears, oh, I never thought of that, like that kind of thing. Oh, I feel frightened. I don't know what's going to happen, whatever that is, as opposed to what we would call like downtown stuff, mm-hmm. which is sounds more like German, like the Pina Bausch of it all.
Yeah.
That the downtown stuff here is stuff that is, look, no show is going to be everybody's cup of tea, regardless of where they're
also
doing
Wicked
it.
Is not everybody's
no. No, not at all. Yeah. I have some notes, frankly. But the downtown stuff is, it's much more raw mm-hmm. because it doesn't have the money behind it. It doesn't have the capability of the set design, the lighting design, the sound design, all of that stuff. The most sophisticated of that is on Broadway.
Yes.
Because it's the most expensive.
Yeah. Do you feel, while you're acting, do you feel the money?
Honestly, no, that's a really good question.
Do you feel the pressure of the money behind you?
You don't feel the pressure of the money in the moment, like as you're going. I feel that sometimes the pressure that you can feel is especially like Broadway-wise, if you're doing a new show. Previews of a Broadway show are not for the faint-hearted. You are exposed, especially now with the social media, because these people who go on these little chat boards and say whatever the hell they want to say, once you start previews, you're doing the show at night and you're rehearsing in the day. And you're often, unless you're doing a revival, but even if you're doing a revival, you are doing change, like staging changes.
Edits or cut down.
Yeah. If you're doing a brand new show, I mean, Wild Party, I remember during previews, there was a day I had a change of some, no, like a little or big, whatever, in every single scene in the show. And at the end of the show, I had a brand new song that I had learned that morning. I was only 30. So my brain was fresh. My brain was like, yep, got it. Very much concentrating.
That's a pressure.
But that's pressure. And that wasn't even on a Broadway scale, especially now. I mean, Broadway shows cost millions and millions of dollars. There's not one person producing it. Look at the front page of inside of for the show yeah. in the playbill.
Yeah.
Look at the number of names that are above the title. Those are all of the producing entities. Some of those producing entities are actually a bunch of people who all get together, put their investment into a pool, and that pool is called whatever. All of those people, not all of those people, the people who are at the top, literally listed, those are the lead producers. They have a say. They can come into rehearsal and be like, I really don't like that sweater, or I really don't like that song, or I really don't like that actor, or I really don't like whatever. And they have to be regarded. They're putting millions with an M of dollars into this thing to make it go. So sometimes the shows end up being what I call a meatloaf show, not the singer, but the dish, which is meatloaf is just basically what's in the fridge. I don't know. But it becomes like a meatloaf show because they're like, we have to cut that because blah, blah didn't like that. And we have to put that person in the show because blah, blah's cousin, whatever.
Yeah.
And really, once you've started previews, even though you're making changes, you're in, you're done. It's so expensive to try to make massive changes on a Broadway scale while you're in previews. There is something sometimes very moving about quote unquote downtown art because they are telling story just using this cup, this brolly, and a piece of tinfoil. And they're making art and they're telling you a story. The higher up the capitalism rank that you go, which the highest is a Broadway show, there's so much money on the line. And you can feel the stress as an actor, sometimes just perfume coming off of the director, the choreographer, the producers, the writers. You're like, oh my God, I'm choking on your anxiety. I'm trying to remain calm, but holy cow, get away from me. because they're all freaking out. Because they see something different.
But doesn't that make you freak out also?
Yes. Yes. So basically it's a building of people attempting to not freak out. And then one of them will lose their minds and like throw something. That's where I feel like you feel the money negatively. Where you feel the money positively mm-hmm. as a performer, if you're lucky, is being in a show in which there is care being taken. I mean, Elphaba, you have a dedicated dresser. You have one human being who follows you the whole show for any of your needs, who also helps change you and all that stuff, but hands you water, hands you a lozenge, hands you a spray, gives you a tissue. Like I had never had that before.
Yeah.
And when I got in there, I remember I would have something in my hand and I would look for somewhere to put it down. And she'd be like, I got it.
It stressed me out.
It totally stressed me out. And at first I fought it. And I was like, no, I got it. I'm okay. And then I thought, So she's been here longer than you. I was the fifth person. She has served four other women in this capacity. Some shows, they'll set up, rightfully so, they will set up physical therapy. A show like Wicked, you get a facial because you're green and it kind of can wreak havoc. Not really, but it can. And that's all money.
Yeah, and also you can see it on stage because in a thing like Death Becomes Her is like the craft and the everything is taken care of.
Yeah.
It's just like there's no loose ends or there's
no... And it's still live theater, right?
Yes,
and
yes.
things still go wrong. And sometimes the levitator does not work at the end of Act 1.
The cherry picker.
The cherry picker, correct. And when that happens, it's pretty devastating because you're like, this is a pretty big moment. Oh, well, I can't fix it.
Bin ja auch so ein bisschen hingefahren mit der Theorie, dass in Amerika diese Genregrenzen oder diese Einteilung zwischen ernster und unterhaltender Kunst nicht so streng ist, so strikt ist wie in Deutschland. Das ist sie, glaube ich, auch nicht, aber trotzdem ist die Sache natürlich komplexer, als man denkt. Zur Sprache kam das Ganze in einem Interview mit Marvin Carlson, Der ist Professor für Theaterwissenschaft an der University of Washington, University of New York, ist inzwischen 90 Jahre alt. Ich glaube, vor 10 Tagen hatte er seinen 90. Geburtstag und hat viele Standardwerke zur Theaterwissenschaft, Theatergeschichte geschrieben. Er arbeitet von Amerika aus, ist aber ein Riesenfan von deutschem Theater. Ich glaube, wenn ich mich recht entsinne, ist die Sommernachtstraum-Inszenierung von Karin Bayer am Hamburger Schauspielhaus eine seiner absoluten Lieblingsinszenierungen. Und er hat mir ein bisschen darüber erzählt, wie im akademischen Bereich auf diese Trennung geschaut wird, auch wie das Publikum selber vielleicht drauf schaut. Hier Marvin Carlson. Das Gespräch hat per Zoom stattgefunden, deswegen ist der Sound so ein bisschen
Let me first say that there is a fairly clear difference between the academic theater world and the professional theater world in the United States. Now, to some extent, that's true in Germany also, but we don't really have places like Gießen, for example. Let me start with the academic world, which I know the best. When I began my career, this was in the 1960s, the situation was very much what you described. That is to say, theater, at least in the universities, theater was considered an art, basically, and you studied it as an art, like painting or music, the Greeks and Shakespeare and Schiller and so on. People may have liked vaudeville, burlesque, circus, even musical theater. They may have liked that, but they were not considered art. They were essentially popular culture or popular entertainment. We didn't study opera either because that was studied in the music departments. We never had a course in opera, for example. Now, much of that has changed, and it really changed around the turn of the century in the 1990s and early 21st century due to a great interest in theater studies in what we call performance, and I'm sure you've run into this. Richard Schechner was one of the leaders in that, but there were a number of other people. What performance really meant was that the old idea of high art and low art disappeared, or largely disappeared academically, and we considered theater as a social and cultural phenomenon, which included Shakespeare, but also included burlesque, striptease, and in the opinions of some people, even sporting events, some baseball or whatever. One particularly important thing was that musical comedy, which always used to be considered popular entertainment, became a respectable subject and now is one of the most important areas of discussion, of course, because America has such an important history of musical comedy. Now, in the theater itself, that is, in the professional theater, there still is a feeling that what is being done in the major theaters is art, and circus and other things are entertainment. That's true of the general public as well. But it's not true in the universities. And indeed, my program here changed its name about 15 years ago. It used to be a Department of Theater. Now it's a Department of Theater and Performance. And what that means is we don't make a distinction between fine art and entertainment. They're all part of a general cultural phenomenon that we study. It's a complicated situation in the United States because there's a rather different attitude in the academy, in the universities, than in the professional theater or in the general public. That is, if you would ask my mother, who is no longer with us, what's the difference between circus or burlesque and Broadway, she would of course say, well, Broadway is art. And so that the general public in the United States still makes that distinction. One quick thing to add is that, again, within the theater, many of my colleagues feel that Broadway is really entertainment And real art in theater is experimental theater.
Yeah, that's interesting because I wanted to ask the same thing because my impression looking in from Germany, I mean, I love Broadway theater since I was a gay kid. I love listening to Broadway cast recordings, everything. So I love it dearly. But if you look at it with like those critical German eyes, you would always think, this is not what we consider art in Germany.
Well, exactly, exactly. And again, most of my colleagues don't go to Broadway, partly because it's very expensive now, but partly because it doesn't have anything like the artistic claims that the German theater has. And by that, I mean the subject matter, the openness to political controversy, the openness to theoretical and philosophical questions, the openness. In short, the Broadway theater largely, and this has been true for my lifetime, the Broadway theater has been essentially entertainment. Again, if you ask my mother or my cousins, you're going to New York, what art are you seeing? They'll say, well, I'm going to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And I will say, are you going to the theater? And they say, well, that's entertainment. There's a very different idea than the traditional idea of Germany. In Germany, we don't have a word like Bildung. And it's significant that we don't have such a word. And if I would say to a German, why do you go to the theater? They might well say that, they might well invoke Bildung. Yeah. No American would say that. Obviously, we don't have the word for that. Education is not the same thing.
Was mir in Amerika sehr aufgefallen war, war die Bereitschaft des Publikums, sich auf Stücke oder die Sachen einzulassen, die sie gesehen haben. Also das war überhaupt gar keine Frage. Also gar nicht diese zurückgelehnte deutsche Haltung, ich möchte überzeugt werden, ich schaue mir erstmal an, was das hier ist, sondern das Publikum in Amerika ist sehr dabei, gleich von Sekunde eins. Also ich weiß nicht, ob das an den Ticketpreisen liegt, dass man sagt, oh, das war jetzt so teuer, jetzt möchte ich hier aber auch gute Stimmung haben, übernehme Verantwortung quasi, diese gute Stimmung auch zu erzeugen. Oder ob das einfach so eine amerikanische Grundoffenheit ist. Auf jeden Fall gibt es diese große Bereitschaft des Publikums sofort auf 190 zu sein. Davon hat Julia auch erzählt. Am Broadway ist das natürlich auch üblich und da gibt es auch so einen wahnsinnigen Fankult, gerade bei so einer Show wie Wicked, dass da die Protagonistinnen wirklich auch sehr beobachtet werden, sehr verehrt werden. Die Leute stehen an der Tür und holen sich Autogramme, schreiben Briefe und so weiter. Und darüber habe ich auch mit Taylor Mack gesprochen, der dann wiederum eher so aus dem Performance- und Drag-Bereich kommt. Er hat diese 24-Stunden-Show über die Geschichte der amerikanischen Musik gemacht, die er ja eben auch in Berlin hier gespielt hat. Ganz toll. Und ich habe eine kleine Try-Out gesehen von ihm in New York, wo er Seemannslieder, queere Seemannslieder ausprobiert hat vor einem kleinen Publikum. Und genau, mit ihm habe ich über die Rolle des Publikums gesprochen und diese Erwartungshaltung, die das amerikanische Publikum häufig auch hat, welche Vor- und welche Nachteile das auch haben kann. Hier ist Taylor Mack.
I mean, the Germans are amazing, but they will, it's hard to get a German to laugh.
Oh, yeah.
And they will, there's a weird etiquette that you have when you come to see theater where you basically sit on your hands and at the end you explode in appreciation for the work. Right, there's this like everyone's cheers and claps louder than anybody, you know, at the end of the show, but you don't show your emotion throughout the entire show. And that's just not the American way. We're like, we gave you a joke and we want, if you didn't laugh, that meant that something was wrong, you know, like in our craft and our, you know, and this, it's, the cultures are very different. You really understand that when you, as a performer, you know.
In Germany, we have this, I think it's Brecht who said like, oh, I want the audience to lay back and like this, smoke a pipe and look like analyzing the thing that's happening there. Right. And I think it's still somehow in the German audience. We're like, convince me. Yeah. Okay. And here I have I had the feeling it's like curtain opens, Michelle Williams, and people are like
convinced.
Going crazy.
Yeah. I mean, that's a beautiful aspect of American culture is the ugly side of that is you have to do the right thing for that, which she came out in a dress that wasn't glittery and glamorous and perfectly fit her and da-da-da-da, the audience wouldn't necessarily do that. Because they hit all the marks, the audience is like, yes, we're here. We're here for the show.
Yes.
It's so clearly, this is either your taste or it isn't. There's no confusion in the marketing.
No.
Right?
Not at all.
So the people that are there have bought in before they bought the tickets, and they're ready, you know, and they just want to enjoy themselves and they want to be satisfied with their purchase, and they come with the expectation that they've asked for a burger their way and they're going to get it their way. And so that's that audience. And then what becomes very challenging is to make the kind of art that doesn't do that. Work with that audience and try to figure out how to convince them that your art, your craft and your art isn't bad and something to be dismissed or ignored simply because it doesn't give them what they were expecting. I believe in surprise, and I believe that when you surprise people, and by surprise, I mean many things, but one of the things I mean is delight. You know, when you delight people, their hearts open, and then they're ready to live, right? But oftentimes people come to culture or experience or just engagement on the street with closed hearts. Mm-hmm. So it's like the theater is this place where we can all practice together how to open up our hearts.
Yeah, that's not very German.
No. But by hearts, I also mean minds, thoughts, the things that we wonder about, the debates we have. But how do we open up our hearts so that we can have real debates as opposed to just my opinion, your opinion? And that's not a debate. It's not Socratic. It's not a question, you know? Yeah. So the goal is like, how can entertainment be the thing that brings us to a communal consideration?
At the moment, what do you think like theater can do political wise, the whole, or is there, should theater do?
I'm probably not, definitely not the first person to say this because, you know, it's an obvious thing. I believe it feels pretty obvious that the issue is isolation. People are isolated. So they're not, you know, people who aren't part of a resistance have isolated themselves. They're donating their dopamine to their phones. They don't want to hang out with people. They don't feel at ease with people. They don't want to practice being around people. Other people are the enemy. I've got to isolate myself to my tribe instead of see, you know, the great American experiment as a communal consideration, instead of see multi-ethnic gathering as something that can help everybody, instead of seeing the world as something that we're all living in and so we all must take responsibility for and care for, you know, instead it's become mine, gotta protect mine. And
theater is like the opposite.
And maybe. Theater can be the opposite. The theater is a place where we gather people together. We can, you know, it doesn't always work that way. It can be isolating to go to the theater often, but I think what it can do is bring people together and give them the experience of having communal consideration. So yeah, more theater, not less. Theater that asks you to be sitting next to a stranger, for you to learn about the play because they laughed in a part that you didn't laugh, to learn about the play because you laughed and your neighbor didn't laugh, and you think, oh, maybe I didn't understand that was actually more serious than I thought it was.
Mit Taylor Macks Forderung More Theater, More Theater, More Theater endet diese erste Folge des Rückblicks auf das Etablissement in den USA 2025. Das waren jetzt eine Menge vielleicht auch eher theoretischer Gedanken, historischer Gedanken. In der nächsten Folge wird es dann eher um das Subjektive gehen, also die Persönlichkeiten, die ich getroffen habe in Amerika, zum Teil sehr außergewöhnliche Geschichten haben und in sehr außergewöhnlichen Bereichen im Theater arbeiten, die man vielleicht hierzulande auch so außerhalb der Hochkultur sehen könnte. Aber gerade diese Persönlichkeiten machen das amerikanische Theater einfach auch zu dem, was es ist. Das war so ein bisschen meine Beobachtung. Also Das Subjektive spielte einfach eine ganz große Rolle. Also Leute, die sagen, ich habe dieses und jenes verrückte Interesse und darüber schreibe ich jetzt ein Stück mit mir selber im Mittelpunkt. Ich hatte ja auch schon so ein bisschen in den Folgen erzählt, dass da gerade so diese Solo-Show so ein totales Comeback feiert in Amerika. Und damit befassen wir uns in der nächsten Folge dieses Rückblicks. Das waren jetzt die Theories und beim nächsten Mal geht es dann wieder mehr um die Stories. Ich hoffe, ihr hattet auch so Spaß. Bis zur nächsten Folge im Etablissement.